Welcome to the Deeper Look podcast for Restoration Church. Each week, we're going to take the passage we're looking at on Sunday and ask questions and go deeper in conversation than we would normally have time to in a gathering. We're asking four big questions. What does this tell us about God? What does this tell us about ourselves? How does this help us love our neighbor? And how can we put this into practice? We're following along the narrative lectionary that's taking us from creation to Pentecost, the full redemptive narrative of Scripture. You can find resources, Bible reading plans at restorationlex.com/restoried. Again, thanks so much for listening. Here we go. Welcome, my people, to the Deeper Look podcast. We are, as always, looking at our passages from the narrative lectionary, our restoried journey as we walk through the Scriptures. We find ourselves today in Isaiah chapter 61, our very last passage in the Old Testament. Caleb, 14 weeks in, if you could sum up in one sentence what you've experienced in the Old Testament, what would it be? On the spot.
Yeah, on the spot, real short. We've moved essentially from creation through fall to almost no hope. That's kind of where we're at, and we're turning the corner. We're seeing that there actually is hope, that there can be new creation again, that the fall, the bad, the exile, all the nitty-gritty stuff, the stuff that just kind of brings you down, it's not the end of the story. So that's kind of where we're at right now. In my opinion.
Yeah, Isaiah 61, it serves really as a good bridge passage from Old Testament to New Testament, because it is a promise of the one who will come and liberate them. But also, as we will see in about a month or so in January, it's Jesus's mission statement. He stands up in front of a group of people and says, this has been fulfilled in your hearing about Isaiah 61, 1 through 3 specifically. And so this was an important passage for Jesus. We can't get too much into that today because we'll have to talk about it when we actually get to that part of Luke.
Right.
But if Jesus sees this as his mission statement, as his disciples, we should probably pay pretty close attention to what's happening here. So.
Yeah.
So Isaiah 61, written from what we can tell, coming out of exile, it's speaking to that. Caleb, what's your thoughts on what's happening here? It's a poem, but what's Isaiah describing?
Yeah, so you know, Isaiah is kind of an interesting book, right? Let me take a step back. When you approach the Bible, it's really hard to take just one passage without taking everything else into context that's around it. And kind of in the biblical scholar world, we call that proof texting, when you just take one verse or two verses and say something about those verses without taking everything else into context. And this is one of those passages that gets taken out of context because people don't understand the setting of it. Like what has happened, what's going on, who are the people that this is being written to? And kind of in a nutshell, you've got captives, you've got prisoners, you've got brokenhearted, you've got poor in this particular passage. And that doesn't mean just this like spiritual thing. These are physical descriptors, people who are poor, people who are brokenhearted, who are aching from the inside out. People who have been taken captive by the Assyrians. They've been taken to Babylon. And I believe this is towards the end of the exile, if I'm not mistaken. I would have to triple check that, so take that with a grain of salt. And release from darkness for prisoners or for the blind, people being able to see again. Saw some translations, but this, it's a people who've been abused by another nation, have just had the world rocked. Life's not good. They need some hope. They kind of, like we were talking about, this is kind of a transition point. So that's the setting for this particular passage. And the people are there, those Israelites, they've been abused, carried off, taken advantage of, manipulated. I mean, all the things that you can find in any psychology manual, these people have suffered. So that's kind of where we're at.
Absolutely. And you say it taken out of context, there's a line of thought that would look at this and say that, you know, the Sovereign Lord has come to bring good news to the spiritually poor, to the spiritually brokenhearted, to those who are captive, but captive by sin, and that this is not a physical reality, but it's actually just a spiritual metaphor for what Jesus is doing inside our heart. And I don't think that that belief is destructive by any stretch of the imagination, but as you read this, as you said, that's not what the original hearers would have heard whatsoever. This would have been a literal freedom from the captivity, from the poverty, from the brokenheartedness that they had experienced. And so I think from that, we not only should understand it in that context, but also understand that in our modern world, like, this isn't just a spiritual calling that Jesus gives. It is, but it's also a physical calling. I mean, good news is for the poor, for the brokenhearted, for the captive, for the prisoner. And that's in the here and now and not just back then. And I don't think you can understand the path clearly enough without that. I'd love to just read it here because I would,
yeah.
Verses 1 through 11. Well, that's the whole chapter, but I'll go ahead and get to, let's at least do the first four verses here, read through that. It says, "The Spirit of the Sovereign Lord is on me because the Lord has anointed me to proclaim good news to the poor. He has sent me to bind up the brokenhearted, to proclaim freedom for the captives and release from darkness for the prisoners, to proclaim the year of the Lord's favor and the day of the vengeance of our God, to comfort all who mourn and provide for those who grieve in Zion, to bestow on them a crown of beauty instead of ashes, the oil of joy instead of mourning, and a garment of praise instead of a spirit of despair. They will be called oaks of righteousness, a planting of the Lord for the display of his splendor. They will rebuild the ancient ruins and restore the places long devastated. They will renew the ruined cities that have been devastated for generations. Strangers will shepherd your flocks. Foreigners will work your fields and vineyards, and you will be called priests of the Lord. You will be named ministers of our God. You will feed on the wealth of nations, and in their riches you will boast." I'm just going to read the whole thing. Let's keep going. "Instead of your shame, you will receive a double portion, and instead of disgrace, you will receive your inheritance. And you will inherit a double portion in your land, and everlasting joy will be yours. For I, the Lord, love justice. I hate robbery and wrongdoing. My faithfulness, I will reward my people and make an everlasting covenant with them. Their descendants will be known among the nations and their offspring among the peoples. All who see them will acknowledge that they are a people the Lord has blessed. I delight greatly in the Lord. My soul rejoices in my God, for he has clothed me with garments of salvation and arrayed me in the robe of his righteousness, as a bridegroom adorns his head like a priest, and as a bride adorns herself with jewels. For as the soil makes the sprout come up and the garden causes seeds to grow, so the Sovereign Lord will make righteousness and praise spring up for the nation." So, Isaiah 61. And as you hear that, obviously, as we said, this is a very literal, like, promise that of what would happen. They would come out of exile, rebuild Jerusalem, and restore it. And that's what we see in Ezra and Nehemiah and you know, part of the story within that as well. I think it's interesting, Caleb, that Jesus frames his mission as taking people out of exile and rebuilding what was lost. And so there's something about our discipleship that is leaving behind the place of captivity and exile, and moving back towards the promise of what was and rebuilt to what can be once again. And I think that's a great way of framing it, of understanding what Jesus is doing, that we are coming out of our own exile, our own captivity to Babylon, you know, America, if you will, and we are learning and building God's kingdom on earth as it is in heaven, and restoring the ancient ruins. We are taking what began in the garden and moving towards the city at the end, as you always say, from creation to new creation. And that's massively important, I believe, to understand reading this.
Yeah, and I kind of actually want to, if it's okay with you, to hit the reverse button and go back to maybe the trying to understand this from a spiritual perspective thing too, because I think that's going to make the rest of our conversation make more sense. And here, I'll just be completely transparent. I remember a time in my life when I would read this passage and I would read Jesus quoting in Luke chapter 4, I think it's 18, 19 and 20, quoting this, and think to myself, oh, this is just a spiritual way of saying Jesus is restoring us from sin. And I kind of grew up, or I maybe not grew up, I was surrounded by some people that were very wary of social justice. And some of that concern is good and some of it's bad. Some of it's good in the sense that helping people just to help them without the gospel, without good news, yeah, that's, I mean, at the end of the day, we want people to know Jesus, period, because Jesus is the one who ultimately restores. But at the same time, you don't just focus on that so much that it's kind of one of the old sayings I've heard a lot. Someone's not willing to listen to you talk about Jesus if all they can hear is the hunger pains in their stomach. And this kind of has the same tone to some of that. You've got this passage starting off with proclaiming good news to the poor. And then you've got these physical things that are happening too. Freedom from captivity, releasing prisoners from darkness, binding up the brokenhearted. So it's kind of a two-sided coin, especially when we think about Jesus. And I don't want to get into that too much because I know we're going to discuss that in a few weeks. But I think it's really important to kind of accept the historical fact that Isaiah was talking to people who were abused. It wasn't just a spiritual matter, it was a physical matter, in the same sense that Jesus is flesh and blood and both divine at the same time. You've kind of got that going on here too. You can't have one without the other. You can't even talk about this from a spiritual perspective if you don't acknowledge the physical suffering in it. That's scripture. We've seen that from Genesis to Isaiah at this point, and we'll see that in the New Testament as well. So I just want to, again, I know I'm kind of beating a dead horse, but I want to hammer that home that this is a flesh and blood thing. Like Jesus was flesh and blood that walked the face of the earth. And we can't understand Jesus without understanding, falling into modern day Gnosticism where everything is just spiritual and there is this non-physical thing. So one of the things that kind of hit me when I was studying this passage this week, and I'm going to kind of jump into our first question. What does this reveal about who God is? The thing that just kept coming to me over and over, like acknowledging this flesh and blood piece, is that you have to acknowledge death in the passage. And I think about family and friends and funerals that I've presided over, family and friends who've passed on, who have died. And I think that's one of the things you have to come to grip with in this particular passage. There are people who have died in captivity, people who have died brokenhearted, people who have died poor when this was written. And we've got to wrestle with that to a degree. Because when, like you read later in this particular passage, God restores everything. God makes everything new. God plants new seeds. So as far as what it's saying about who God is, I mean, it's another resurrection passage, a restoration passage for our restoration fam. God takes all of this and breathes new life into it. But we have to like accept the brokenness in order for God to breathe new life into things. And I'm very confident that these people had accepted their brokenness, had been forced to accept their brokenness. So yeah, just starting with that first question, God is breathing new life into the people in this passage. A king, a servant, a Messiah has been anointed and is making everything well again.
Yeah, absolutely. That's good. To know the character of God and bringing restoration in that same way. If you look back where we were in Joel this past week, Joel 2, it's the same promise that God will restore what the locusts have destroyed. That there's, whenever we see that kind of descent into death, there's always the promise of resurrection with our God. And that's such a beautiful, beautiful part of every single story. It seems like we've been like, there's always this cyclical pattern of where we see death and destruction and sin, God redeems and restores and resurrects life, for sure. Yeah. I look at verse 8 when I think about what's to say about God. Verse 8 says, I, the Lord, love justice. That word mishpat in the Hebrew, which is righteous judgment. God is judge. And we don't like to think about God as judge. It seems as we would, you know, equate as Americans judgmental. But for a people like you talk about who were, you know, abused and oppressed, to have righteous judgments against those who have been against the oppressor is good news. And that what mishpat means is literally a level playing field, equity and just relationships, just that everybody gets equal treatment, equal judgment before a just judge. And that God, as he is speaking this through Isaiah, is concerned with that God's not just concerned with our spiritual lives. God is concerned with creating a just world for his people to live in. And as his priest, as he says later in the passage, we should as well be concerned with that same world of justice, of equity for our neighbors. And so I think that's what I see. God as just judge, and that's good news. That he is putting the world to rights. It has to be good news. So
yeah, and the other good news part of this too is a part of the reason that the Israelites ended up in captivity to begin with is because they had turned their back on God. That's clearly recorded in scripture in so many different places. And essentially, God was like, okay, you want to do it your way, fine. This is what it looks like to do it your way, which is like a one word summary. It looks like death. That's what happens when we do things our way. And the really neat thing about God is that even though he allowed them to go down their own path, to do their own thing, he still comes back to them. I still want to make you whole. I still want to set you free. Even though you turned your back on me, I mean, that's a part of the story. I still want to make you whole. So I think it's in verse, it's the very first verse, the release from darkness for prisoners. With some of my work with the rescue mission, I get to work with people who've recently come out of prison. And it's no secret that when someone comes out of prison, there's a stigma. People won't hire you. People won't trust you. You basically already got the deck of cards stacked against you if you're a felon. And if I've read this over prisoners, and it's always to see their reaction for them to understand that despite the past, whether it was partly their fault, partly the justice system's fault, whatever the situation may be from one extreme to the other, it's so cool to see them go, God still loves me. God still wants to set me free. God did set me free. And I think that's the other thing we kind of have to take into account when we read this passage, is acknowledging that the Israelites weren't totally blameless in all of this. And the big thing about God is, despite their sin, God still wants to make things right. Yeah, they were taken advantage of by other people, and that's the bigger picture. But there's also the other side of the story of, we kind of turned our back on God, and God still loves us. God still wants to bind up the brokenhearted and proclaim freedom for the prisoner and stuff like that. So, yeah.
That's awesome. Which brings me, I think, right perfectly into what does this say about ourselves? And that is, as we see the sovereign Lord binding up the brokenhearted, you know, freeing the prisoners, good news to the poor. There's a turn in the second half of verse 3 that starts referring to they. They will rebuild the ancient ruins. Like that, it is the task of those who have been freed from oppression and the poor. God turns over the keys to the kingdom to people like us, and that out of our own freedom and out of our own liberation and how the gospel changes us, we are sent out. And so it's, I think what this speaks to what it, I think it says about ourselves is that our ministry is essentially flows out of our freedom that we have in Jesus, that we don't just go out and serve and whatnot. Like we start with what freedom we have found in the gospel, and it overflows from that. And when we get that backwards, when we try to work good works out and to get something changed within us, it never works that way. But it's just such a cool reminder that God really does say it's not me. It's not those who have done it right. It's for the oppressed. You will be the ones who build back what has been lost and what is broken. You'll be participants in the resurrection, really.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's what that speaks about us as image bearers, as the people of God, that not only does that flow out of us, but that we can expect to join God in his restoration work. I'll say real quick, I talk about this Sunday, but that's one of the reasons we named the church Restoration. These verses right here, where we believe Jesus is restoring people who restore the world. I mean, that's what's happening in the first four verses here. Like, God is restoring people, and then he commissions and sends those same people to go out and be restorers in the world. It's where we got the name Restoration, looking at this passage. And so for us, what this says about us, ourselves, is that this is our calling, just as it is Jesus's calling, and it comes out of what he does for us. So,
yeah, and I mean, to kind of build up on that, God doesn't call the person who's got it all together in this particular passage. The anointed one is calling out to the ones who are broken, who do have that story, who do have that institutional history, so to speak, to build on and to change things for the future. So you'd mentioned justice back in verse 8. Mm-hmm. And one of the interesting things about this, I looked up a Jewish translation of this passage earlier this week, the I Hate Robbery and Wrongdoing piece, as far as what it talks about, or like, what does it say about who we are? More specifically, that's kind of talking about robbery and wrongdoing in our offerings up to God. And in the Jewish culture of this time, pre-exile, kind of what that looked like, abusing our offerings or abusing worship to God, it was essentially holding all these fasts, holding all of these feasts, and doing all this stuff to try to please God while there were people on the outskirts suffering. They were just ignoring them. And I talked about this passage being kind of sandwiched or placed in a bunch of other different passages. And one of the things that this passage, the longer you go through it into the next chapter, it starts replaying stuff in previous chapters. And that idea of being a robber or a wrongdoer and your offering up to God actually occurs in some previous chapters next to this particular passage. And we're still guilty of that. Like we have to acknowledge that we probably all have done that. We've all probably all done the worship for show thing at some point in our lives. And I think we have to wrestle with the question of what it actually means to be a Christian, which is why I love Restoration's kind of tagline or mission so much, being people who've been restored, who then become restorers of the world. Like, that's a part of our identity. That's what's happening literally in this passage as you've painted. And it starts with that acknowledgement of, yeah, I've messed things up in the past. But yeah, oh, and yeah, that has caused some brokenheartedness, caused some captivity. But the anointed one, Jesus, that we later see in Luke 4, is the one who sets all of that right. So as we go about our restoration business, it's because of who Jesus is as the anointed one, and acknowledging that it's Jesus who's doing the restoring and allowing us to partner with him in all of that. Because all of these things that happen in these next verses, they mean nothing without the anointed one. They mean absolutely nothing without Jesus coming along and being a part of that. And I think that's probably what some people's fear when they hear the word social justice is. They think Jesus is being taken out of the picture. And again, part of that's true, part of it's not true. So what it says about us is we've got that same thing available to us. We've got the anointed one available to us who brings us through all of that so that we can be those restorers. And it's not just something we're expected to do of our own accord or of our own power. I mean, we just talked, well, we didn't talk, but last week it was about the pouring out of the Spirit, and the Spirit's the one who empowers us at all of this. That's kind of what Joel was talking about. So yeah, really cool passage. I've talked a lot. I'm just kind of jabbering at this point, but yeah, between what it says about God and what it says about us, I know I, for one, am really glad that when we talk about Jesus in a few weeks using this passage, that Jesus decided to make this his mission because he shares that mission with us. And it's a really exciting mission.
Yep, absolutely. And you brought up that word anointed that's used there in verse 1, which I think is sometimes an abused concept within certain circles of Christianity, whereas certain people are anointed and certain people aren't. When Jesus, in this case, in Old Testament context, God anoints and puts this mantle of authority and holiness on, you know, select people to accomplish his purposes, but by his Spirit, and what we celebrated last week, we talked about last week in Joel 2, by his Spirit on Pentecost, like, we have been anointed by God's Spirit for the same ministry, for the same mission that Jesus has been for. So that's important to see as well, and not to take an Old Testament mentality as if, we do this a lot with pastors and ministry folks, like, they're God's anointed and we're just the little people down here. And that's just not very same thing. So how's the self from our neighbor? You can almost, how do we put this into practice? Like, you can answer these questions as one.
It all merges into one thing, it seems like. And Justin, real quick, talking about all of the people being anointed. I mean, that actually happens in this passage too. We've got some of these weird verses about, I was trying to find it, but essentially like the foreigner coming to tend your vineyard. And again, this is a poem, so you kind of have to understand it from a poetic sense. But what's going on is that the people have become priests, all the people together. God's called out ones. They've become priests. And it's not just one priest or another priest. It's like the whole people. And they're inviting people into this priesthood. They're inviting people into this kingdom. Sometimes we've got this stranger, stay away from us, don't mess with our stuff. And in this particular passage, you've got strangers literally coming alongside you, taking care of your source of income or your livelihood and things like that. So yeah, this priesthood thing, verse 6, and you'll be called priests of the Lord, and you'll be named ministers of our God. So it's really important that if you're listening to this, you know that you are a priest, that you are a minister. It's not just Justin, not just me, not just Hannah, not just the elders or the leaders. Like, everyone who decides to partner with Jesus or partner with this anointed one, so to speak, you're a minister, you're a priest. So embrace it.
Absolutely. Absolutely. That's a good word. Yeah. And to kind of flow out of that, how it helps us love our neighbor, can't talk, is I think going back to where we were at the beginning, to see our neighbor as a whole person, that there's not really a separation in the scriptures like we have in this dualistic, like you said, modern Gnostic understanding of people, where there's a spiritual part of life and then there's a physical part of life. Like, the Bible's written to a people who sees those things as one. And so when I look at guy walking in prison or walking into the rescue mission, it's not just his physical needs, it's his spiritual needs. But for those who would stand on the outside looking in and say that, if you focus and call people to that and say, well, you're not focused on their spiritual needs, their physical needs, you need to, you know, not do that so much and just preach the gospel, as has been said before. Well, the gospel, according to Jesus in Luke 4, is this. It is love for the whole person and not just their spiritual life. And so, yeah. I think when I think about just a normal, you know, everyday person we might run into, maybe our neighbor or friend, like, they have physical needs, but they have spiritual needs as well. And God wants the gospel to restore the whole person, and not just certain parts. So I guess how it helps me love my neighbor is it helps me to see my neighbor holistically, both whether they are rich or poor, and various backgrounds, whatnot. Like we all are one whole person of physical, emotional, mental, spiritual needs, all that the gospel speaks to, including ourselves, that the gospel speaks to. And so I'm not just separating, praying for someone's soul for their physical needs and or being a reaction against an overreaction on either side. I need to see the whole person. So,
yeah. Yeah. And I think the thing that it speaks to me about, as far as loving my neighbor, then maybe we can figure out the putting this into practice, kind of maybe answering this in reverse helps put it into practice, right? Is this awareness, this recognition that, one, there are broken people out there. I've been broken. Justin, you've been broken. We've all been broken. Sometimes we cause our brokenness. Sometimes other people cause our brokenness. And in this passage, this particular passage, you've probably got a little bit of both and, which is the truth for most of us, is this both and things we've become captive to, or things that have taken us away from Jesus. And we've got to be really careful about going and saying, okay, I understand that person's brokenness. It's okay for them to be broken. But that person knew better. They shouldn't have done that. It's their fault they're broken. You don't see any of that in this passage. You just don't. You see the anointed one coming to preach good news to the poor, to help the broken, to help the prisoner, to help the captive. And if we're created in the image of God, we're created in the image of this anointed one, then it's like, okay, I've got to turn off that filter or that lens that says you're worth helping. Yeah, I don't know that you're worth helping because you did this to yourself, sort of thing. We've got to turn that off because that's not Jesus. And I think that's probably becoming less and less of a thing in this world as the next generation of Christians rise up, but it's still a thing. And history repeats itself if we don't call it out. So yeah, like this pick yourself up by your bootstraps mentality, this you deserve this mentality, this, well, you're worth helping and you're not. So that's not how the anointed one works in this passage. And because of that, because we're created in the anointed one's image, we shouldn't operate like that. So yeah. As far as loving our neighbor, I think for me, that's the practical thing. It's making sure that I'm turning that lens off, because that's not a Jesus lens. That's an enemy lens. And that if it's not Jesus and it's the enemy, that means that's coming from the evil one, because there's nothing that the evil one would delight more in than saying, okay, that person's not worth helping. That person's not worth going after because they did that to themselves. Like, that's where the enemy gets a foothold. And our job as restorers is to kind of wade into that mess, to go after the one sort of thing. So as far as loving your neighbor, that's kind of what comes to my mind.
It's almost like, you know, the statement, God helps those who help themselves, is not in the Bible and is completely antithetical to the gospel itself.
Yeah. A misinterpretation of something in scripture. Yeah.
I mean, and thank God for us, for us as individuals, like that we have not, that God doesn't treat us based upon what we have done or deserve. Like,
right.
That very, you know, seed of grace within us should change the way we see our world as well. So absolutely there. I think in terms of putting it into practice as we move into our final question, the restoration project of this passage, the restoring, the rebuilding, I think wherever we are as followers of Jesus, that has to be part of our lens through which we see the world. What is broken? What is missing? Now let's step in and be the hands and feet, voice of bringing that restoration into our world, not just in a spiritual sense, but in a physical, real world reality. And I don't want to pick on people who use these labels of social justice warriors and just sort of remarks and labels that honestly have been handed down to them, not from their experience, but people have been told if they look this way, then that's what they must be. There is a fear there. And if this mishpat that the Anointed One is bringing, the Lord loves this justice, this mishpat, this equity, the equity, this even level ground for people to have an equal opportunity for just relationships and judgments and whatnot. If that scares you, you should ask why. If God giving the poor and the oppressed an opportunity to experience fullness and wholeness is something that seems worthy of a label in order to try to get people to stop, you should ask why. And it could be because what makes the oppressed being restored nervous is the oppressor is the one who gets nervous about that. And so we should question if we are constantly pushing back against this idea of social justice and the social ramifications of the gospel, it may be because we stand to benefit in ways both conscious and unconsciously that we are not aware of, that that we benefit from the oppressed not being lifted up, not being able to receive wholeness and justice in this life and not just in the next. And so I don't know, I'm rambling a little bit there, but I think how we put this into practice is, as we see, we know, as we say this all the time at Restoration, like Jesus, the Anointed One, is already at work bringing about restoration. And our job is not to go out and find something to do randomly. We should look where Jesus is already at work around us in our city and go and join him in that. And I think that's what practice looks like, is it's you get the spiritual and the mission there, because I have to sit with God and really know where he's sending me within this. And then when I go, I'm not just preaching the gospel of Jesus saving your soul for heaven when you die. I'm stepping into broken places, into broken lives with my own brokenness, and I'm rebuilding what has been broken. I'm a part of God's restoring work in people's lives and in the world, in the real world, right where we are. And that's the justice that God has called us to, no matter what label people on any side want to call it. That's what we're stepping into.
Yeah. So here's my final thought on the practice piece. And I'm going to kind of take it in a different direction, still related to the social justice stuff. I remember when I was kind of against this idea of social justice before I started hanging out at the rescue mission. The thing that kind of drove me in being against it was, or the thing I'd heard, was that, oh, it's a perversion of the gospel. You're just perverting the gospel. The gospel is the death, burial, and resurrection of Jesus Christ. And yes, the good news is the death, burial, and resurrection of Jesus Christ, but that's only one part of the story. That's only one part of it. And the practice, I think, for people who maybe on that side wrestling around with it or haven't thought about it or are nervous about some of the things that have been brought up in this particular chapter is the good news is, yeah, Jesus died and was resurrected, but why? Was it just so we could go sit on some clouds and enjoy the presence of Jesus and that be it for all of eternity? That really doesn't get like at the full picture of it, right? No, it's Jesus was crucified, buried, and resurrected so that he could make things new again, so that death didn't have the final word, so that death wasn't the end of the story. And kind of what that means is binding up the brokenhearted so that they have joy again, freeing the prisoner so that they can see the light of day again outside of a cell, enjoying freedom, releasing the captive so they don't feel held down by the weight of life or the weight of their situation. It's the good news that's being preached in this passage is God's gonna make everything right again and make it better. And you don't get to just settle on the death, burial, and resurrection and that's it without understanding that there's a purpose behind all of it. And it's more than just saving you from sin. It's restoring you from sin. And restoration looks a whole lot like the first one or two, three verses of this particular chapter. So the practice is, do you really know what the good news is? Do you really understand what the gospel is? Or are you just leaning on what you've been told by someone else? If you're just leaning on what you've been told by someone else, maybe you should take some time and research it yourself and dive into it yourself, because it literally might change the rest of the way you live your life. And that's kind of what happened to me. So that would be my words of practice for people this week.
Same. Happened to me as well. And I'll just close by saying and clarifying that when people think about justice and social justice and extremes, listen, we acknowledge and know there are extremes. Mm-hmm. You know, there's two types of justice we see. There's retributive justice and there's restorative justice. And there are, on one side, folks who just want to tear down, who just see the injustice of the world and they want to just, you know, have, you know, anarchy and chaos and just tear down anything that looks like power and whatnot. And yes, you can find lots of examples of that. But what I see more often than not for Christians who are nervous about this stuff is they will jump over the massive group of people who are doing this faithfully with a both and gospel. And they'll look at that and then call everybody that's seeking out the actual good in this world of folks biblical justice, and they'll label that. And there's folks on the other extreme that are highly motivated to make sure that you see the people who are trying to do this faithfully look like the folks that are on the other extreme, which they don't have a lot in common at all, if anything in common. This restorative justice, this coming out of what God has restored in and through us, and bringing about that life is exactly what we are called to, and what Isaiah 61 is calling us to, not just going and tearing everything down and whatnot. Like, God is calling us to rebuild. This rebuild piece is such a huge part, because there are folks who think justice looks like tearing down, but we as followers of Jesus know that justice is restorative. And so we are building people up. As I've heard one pastor say, it's the gospel frees both the oppressed and the oppressor. The oppressor is also released from the burden of this sort of superiority and can experience the grace of Jesus for the first time. We're not just trying to destroy the oppressor. We want the oppressor saved. Mm-hmm. We want to restore it as well. And that's what happens with Mishpat, with justice being brought into the world. We all come to the cross of Christ, to the resurrection, and whether we are poor or rich, we have found this restoration, this rebuilding project within us, and are called to the same thing as we come as equal followers of Jesus, walking towards his restoration together. So,
yeah, man.
Yeah. I know both of us have gone off quite a bit on this one. So
yeah, I didn't expect that. Sorry.
Well, no, this is good. I love it. I mean, this passage is one of my favorites. Very important for us. And we'll obviously hit it again in January when we get to Luke chapter 4. But you can always...
And there's so much more to say.
Oh, there's so much more to say, yes. Caleb at story.org is his email. My email is justin@restorationlex. It's Caleb with a K at story.org.
Yeah.
Acting, talking, questions, comments, jumping in, however that may be. If you see this video on Facebook, you can make a comment in the comment section, ask questions or say something, say amen, say go away, I don't know, say something to us. You're free to do that as well. We'll talk about this passage Sunday on our regular worship service on Facebook Live, and some of you will watch it with your home church or listen with your home church as well. So, Cale, thanks, man. And we will be back in the spot next week as we move into the New Testament.
Yes.
Here we go. Gospel of Luke. So we will see you guys next week. Love y'all.
Yep. Peace.